ESPN Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
This morning, and welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. You are on the clock with Erin Green. It's Thursday, the 1st of February, 2024. And it's our third anniversary of On the Clock. We're very excited. We're not doing it up big today because I got lots to talk about today, but I had to start this show with Mr. Officer by Jacob Miller. Please, Mr. Officer, cool down your temperature. We need to begin talking to each other again. We need to begin rebuilding community with the binds that tie, not with money, not with money. I also, for a very small celebration of the third anniversary, I want to read this poem I found by Mrs. Ona Mitchell Powell Bailey. That's one of my good aunties. And for a long time, I didn't know that she was a poet and a comedian, one of the funniest women in the Bahamas. I want to read this poem quickly, because I want to, like Jacob Miller, attempt to cool down the temperature. You can see in the newspaper, things are hot, hot, hot today. So let me read this poem. It's called Remember When by Ona Mitchell Powell Bailey. Titter, you remember J.P. Sands, that old grocery shop? Used to be on Bay Street, right in front of Prince George Dock. Grandma used to send her there long before she died. She always used to remind me to go on the western side. The first time I had gone there, I didn't know what side she mean. So I went to the side with the girls them, and my Lord, what a scene. I asked the girl for half a pound of lard and a pint of yellow grits. The way she suck her teeth and cut her eye, you'd think she was having fits. I never went that side again. That girl really make me shame. And the way the people stare at me, you would think I just make it to fame. Remember the Savoy Theater where they had the picture show? That's another place on Bay Street where us Negroes couldn't go. Then down there on Charlotte Street, they had Queens College School. Now that was a funny mix of place. Even there they had the white-only rule. You ever see dark brown shades of white or white with kinky hair? Check the register 30 years ago. You'll find discrimination with a flair. Now, you not think all of this is bad, but you ain't hear nothing yet. Wait till you hear about the house of God, then you're gonna really get upset. Look at Trinity Methodist Church, tall, beautiful, and wide. The white folks went through the front door. For the black folks, there was a door at the side. Then there was Cathedral, situated on Marlborough and George Streets. To keep the black folks out, they used to charge for their seats. Now, imagine discrimination in a church called Calvary. If I could remember right, that was where Christ died for you and me. Anyway, Tita, we done passed through all of that. We could go where we like, do what we like. Some of we could even be aristocrat. Remember When, by Ona Bailey.
I enjoy that poem.
Yeah, man.
Mind you, I know about the Methodist Church, the side door. I knew about the charging at the cathedral. But to hear it in verse, to rehash it in verse, it tells, behooves us, to, when we do write bohemian poetry, that we need to create narratives that the next generation will be able to appreciate what's happening now.
Yeah. In fact, the way to distinguish bemoan from behoove, I bemoan in when I stub my toe. That's how you know what bemoan. It's like a complaint, right?
Right. See, what the hooves part, though?
It'll behoove me to get up on these hooves and get going.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like that. I appreciate that.
But these are things we could do, right? Like, education is as fun and exciting as we make it. And the more culturally applicable we make it, the easier or the greater access young people will have to it. I love that poem. And I love all, like you say, all these types of poems that entrench history, right?
But I didn't notice a lot of those West Indian names attached to your auntie's name, by the way. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Bailey and Powell? Was it Powell?
Yeah, but Bailey Bahamian too.
Bailey.
Big Bailey family here.
Yeah. West Indian surnames.
Yes, absolutely.
I just say that's a different time, a different
generation. Yeah, absolutely. Which is another interesting part of history, right? And how these names got here and interwoven into Bahamian families. It's fabulous. So today is a World News Thursday. On Tuesday, we had Sandollar on. But Mr. Mark Palmer and I have lots to talk about this morning. Mr. Palmer is zooming in from a somewhere in the archipelago. Good morning, Mr. Palmer. All right, we're just waiting for him to pull up. So I got some questions on the table for the audience to join in this conversation. Here are the questions. Is lawlessness the same as criminality? Is lawlessness the same as criminality? And if a liar is a thief and a thief is a murderer, what's the thin line between lawlessness and criminality? When does somebody go from just being unrestrained or controlled by law, unruly, to a criminal? And are we thinking about these things? Mr. Palmer, you joining us?
I am indeed. How are you, Aaron?
I'm good. You put down that sweet pineapple?
There's plenty of avocado pears here in Eleuthera.
Yes.
So I'm enjoying those. But yeah, greetings from Eleuthera, from Rock Sound.
Hold on. There's plenty of avocado pears in Eleuthera right now?
Yeah.
It's winter pear season down there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mr. Palmer, let me beg you.
Bring you some back. Hey.
Bring me two avocado pear. Hold on, from a good friend. I want to say happy birthday to Rebecca Ruby Ward from her daughters Rakenia and Kendria and her granddaughter Kefri. And for all of us in the Spot family, we all say happy birthday, Auntie Ruby. I hope you're having a wonderful day. Yeah, so Mr. Palmer, I'm going to need two pair to put in that gift basket. Now that you're in the bread basket, the new bread basket of the Bahamas.
Absolutely. Yeah, plenty growing. There's farming going on here in Eleuthera, which is great to see.
Yes, absolutely. It's great to see. It's also the development and growth in Eleuthera is awesome, right? My only complaint is that less and less fruit is making it to New Providence as local farmers find more and more avenues and spaces to sell their produce in Eleuthera on the ground.
Mm-hmm. There was a big farmers market here on Saturday down at the premises of One Eleuthera, and it was just great. I wasn't actually here, but I heard some really good things about it.
awesome. This is awesome. So listen, I threw out these questions today to the listening audience. They could call in and share their thoughts. Is lawlessness the same as criminality? And if a liar is a thief and a thief is a murderer, when do you go from lawlessness to criminality? And so I wanted to throw those questions out to the audience as a backdrop to our conversation this morning about the Israel-Hamas conflict and the South African case before the ICJ, where they brought Israel before the ICJ to determine whether their actions in Israel and Gaza amount to genocide. You still there? Let's give it 1 second, Mr. Palmer. All right, so I'm going to give
you see the need for that satellite internet thing?
Yeah, because as many options as possible, right?
Would a link, a Skylink thing, wouldn't have dropped.
Starlink.
It wouldn't have dropped. I just say it wouldn't have dropped. He would have been here, and he would have been responding. But go ahead, sorry.
So the intention this morning is to talk about the Israel-Hamas conflict and the case that South Africa brought before the International Court of Justice and the preliminary ruling given by the ICJ. And so I want to start here. As of the 30th of January, 2024, over 28,000 people, 26,637 Palestinian and 1,410 Israeli have been killed in the Israel-Hamas war, including 85 journalists, 75 of which are Palestinian, 4 are Israeli, and 3 Lebanese. And over 136 UNRWA aid workers. The conflict started on October 7th. So I'm going to read from this article just quickly. Hopefully we can get Mark up. And if we can't, then I'll just give a brief reading, and then we can get back into the questions we've thrown out to the audience. Gaza, ICJ ruling offers hope for protection of civilians enduring apocalyptic conditions, say UN expert. The landmark ruling by the International Court of Justice offers the first concrete hope to protect civilians in Gaza enduring apocalyptic humanitarian conditions, destruction, mass killing, wounding, and irreparable trauma, UN experts said today. The ruling is a significant milestone in the decades-long struggle for justice by the Palestinian people, the expert said. The ICJ found it plausible that Israel's acts could amount to genocide and issued 6 provisional measures ordering Israel to take all measures within its power to prevent genocidal acts, including preventing and punishing incitement to genocide, ensuring aid and services reach Palestinians under siege in Gaza, and preserving evidence of crimes committed in Gaza. So now let's take a look at the 6 things the UN is ordering Israel to do about its operation in Gaza. 1, and this comes from the ruling, 1, the court ordered Israel to take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of the UN Convention on Genocide. Referring to protecting Palestinian civilians, the court said Israel should work to prevent killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. The 2nd measure, the court ordered Israel to ensure with immediate effect that its military does not commit any acts described in point 1 above. 3rd measure, the court said Israel shall take all measures within its power to prevent and punish the direct and public incitement to commit genocide in relation to members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. The fourth measure, Israel was ordered to take immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to address the adverse conditions of life faced by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Five, the court ordered Israel to take effective measures to prevent the destruction and ensure the preservation of evidence related to allegations of acts within the scope of the relevant articles in the Genocide Convention. Six, the court said Israel should submit a report to the court on all measures taken to give effect to this order within 1 month as from the date of this order. Producer, Mr. Palmer said he's back in the Zoom room. Mr. Palmer? Let's see, are you there? Okay. Another quick note before we move on.
And Aaron, I heard you read your piece.
Yes.
And I would like to bring it home. Where does the Bahamas stand? I know there are a list of countries who support the Israelis, regarding this war. And there are a number of persons who support South Africa in terms of their petition. And I would like to know, if you know, where does the Bahamas stand? I know where the United States stand, right? And the general Caribbean nations.
I did not find an official position by the Bahamas government, but I am presuming that the Bahamas government is standing in support of the Israeli people's right to defend themselves, but also adhering to the UN provisions and decisions on the matter. It's a difficult place to be, right? And even actors in the U.S., while they support Israel, they are also denouncing what looks like, what appears to be what has been called genocidal attacks, right? And so the U.S. supports Israel, but U.S. actors are also asking Israel to do a number of things that have been declared in the measures, in the ruling, right? Which is to measure your speech, ensure access to humanitarian aid, ensure that you're working to not kill civilians. There's a response here,
but not a ceasefire.
No, not a ceasefire. In fact, this ruling did not go as far as declaring Israel's actions as genocidal. And it did not, I don't think it demanded a ceasefire, but they also acknowledge that a ceasefire is required for most of these measures to be achieved. I wanted to find comments by Netanyahu himself. He is livid that even that the ICJ would even entertain the case brought about by South Africa, but because of their stature or their positioning, their membership in various UN bodies, they sent a high-level team to defend Israel, which suggests that they took the procedures seriously, despite commentary from Netanyahu himself.
So, Aaron, it doesn't really matter what Netanyahu says, but to answer your question before that, I think the Bahamas tends to vote with the international community on these issues because every year there is a resolution in the United Nations that advocates for the two-state solution, and it's usually only two or I think five countries vote against it, and it's the usual ones, U.S., Israel, and then there's a couple of outlying countries down in the South Pacific, like Vanuatu or Samoa. I forget, they're U.S. dependencies. So there is, I would imagine, our government, you know, is for a two-state solution. It tends to vote in that same direction. And so, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, although it didn't, you know, the court case is important because it shows evidence. You know, there is evidence presented, sufficient evidence presented for this to go to trial. So it's a pretty hard thing to achieve because the definition of genocide is very specific. So it is actually a huge victory for South Africa. They may not have gotten the ceasefire element of it. But if you look at the what the court has ordered, it has ordered some very specific things, you know, and it seems from what I'm seeing in the media that the Israelis are not complying. So I think that could open them to some serious legal action in the future.
Absolutely. In fact, if I can just pull a quote from this article, top UN court orders Israel to prevent genocide in Gaza, but stops short of ordering ceasefire. Quote, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the fact that the court was willing to discuss the genocide charges was a, quote, mark of shame that will not be erased for generations, close quotes. He vowed to press ahead with the war. Yeah, I just wanted to put that on the record. So he's not inclined to take these rulings seriously, although the state machinery did by sending the team.
Of course, well, they have to. They have to. But, you know, what was interesting, if you look at the actual voting, it was unanimous apart from Uganda. Uganda voted with Israel in every case, which was really unusual. And I read that Uganda has distanced itself from the opinion written by the Ugandan judge in that hearing or that trial, and because it was the only dissenting judge.
This is really interesting, Mark, because I wonder if our government has produced a position paper or if this was a part of the discussions that took place at the G77 plus China at the meeting that took place in Uganda, whether this was on the table and whether our government made some supranational policy decisions on our behalf without telling us.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's kind of murky, isn't it? But going back to that judgment, there was the fourth one, and I read it was Israel was ordered to take immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to address the adverse conditions of life faced by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Now, Israel voted for that, right? But yes. Uganda voted against that. So that is really peculiar. So Uganda voted not for any provision of urgently needed basic service and humanitarian assistance. So something is really peculiar, don't you think? I mean, I can't imagine anyone voting against. In fact, Israel voted for that because, you know, to be totally inhuman if you voted against it. So
right.
Very strange decision that.
And the votes were very interesting. The first measure passed 15, 4 and 2 against. Second measure, the same thing, 15, 4 and 2 against. The third measure, 16 to 1. The fourth measure, 16 to 1. The fifth measure, 15 to 2. And the sixth measure, 15 to 2. So it's very, very interesting. What's also interesting to me is Israel's claim that they are being attacked and that this level of force is necessary to protect Israel. Because when we look at the stats as of the 30th of January, with over 28,000 people killed, 26,637 of them were Palestinian, 1,410 Israelis.
It doesn't really matter what they say, because you just look at the court ruling. It goes against everything that is coming from official Israeli sources. So they're entitled to voice their opinion, but it doesn't really reflect international opinion or the opinion of the court. So they're kind of in a difficult situation. And I think there are other countries that are now, I can't remember, there's one country that's now going to take the U.S. in front of the international, the ICJ, for aiding and abetting genocide. So I think there's more legal things, but it's not a good optic for Israel, and I think they're losing a lot of public support. You know, I was a big supporter of Israel in the early days, but I cannot support, you know, an asymmetric war. And I think also the other thing, as you educate yourself on the conflict, and I was pretty ignorant in the past, I have to admit, you know, when you look at the news and the media, it starts on October 7th, you know, when the actual conflict started back in 1948, and, you know, the occupation, it's actually an annexation. They've occupied parts of Palestine so long now, it is actually an annexation. And the blockade and then the brutal treatment in a military, you know, enforcement in the West Bank. And if if people actually saw even just a fraction of what was going on in that country, I think a lot of people would you know, have a change of heart. And so we have been propagandized for many years. And I remember watching an interview by this a Jewish guy, Dr. Hajju Meir. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he was an Auschwitz survivor. And he was a kind of a prominent anti-Zionist. And he, in his last interview, he lambasted Zionists as Nazi criminals. That's a pretty heavy accusation coming from a Jew. And he felt that the Israeli Jewish hatred of Palestinians was more deeply grounded than the German hatred of Jews. So there's some powerful stuff coming. That's not from me. That's coming from voices on the path. So I don't think we get the full information of what is going on in that region. You know, we get a certain bit of it after a specific date. But this has been festering for many, many years. And, you know, it's the same with Ukraine-Russia war. We get, you know, it starts on the 22nd of, when was it, February 2022. But they don't tell you about all the history back to the 1990s. You know, and that context is really important for people to make, you know, an impartial or kind of balanced view of it. And I think we don't get the full picture. And I think a lot of people don't see the cruelty and the things that are going on in that region. If they did, I think they would look at it quite differently.
Absolutely. I got a text here for you, Mr. Palmer. It says, ask Mr. Palmer if he thinks Hamas is now sorry for what they started on October 7th.
I doubt they are. I mean, I think this is this battle between the Palestinians and the Israelis, if it can be called a battle, is really an existential one for both of their survivals. You know, if you look at the, you know, sympathize with the Israelis, because when you look at Jewish history and what happened to the Jews, you know, so they see it very much as an existential threat for their survival. And they're gonna, that's why they're taking such a tough stance. And then you look at the Palestinians, you know, they're looking at it as an existential threat for their survival because, you know, you've got Gaza, which has got sort of two-thirds of refugees from other parts of Palestine.
Mark, so, what if this is really about, it has nothing, what if this has nothing to do with religion other than one group's belief that they have the authority to move secular. Another group? And what if it's all about land and power?
That's what, I think you've nailed it. There are groups that look at it, you know, I think a justification is when they look to biblical texts, but that's only one, you know, that's one small part of it. I mean, if you look back at the history, and I've studied the history, I've looked at Operation Dalit, you know, which happened in the 40s when the Israelis, you know, they basically surveyed the whole of Palestine and took the best bits. You know, this survey had been going on from 1946 to 1948, at which point they took control, you know, so they'd already scoped out the land. And it was, you know, when the Nakba in 1948, when they pushed 750,000 Palestinians off the land, they basically took all their land and their property. And so, yes, I think you're right. It is actually, I see it as a land grab. It's being reframed as something different now as sort of, you know, their survival. But you know, if you go into a country and you do that, you know, you're going to make a lot of enemies, right?
Absolutely. Mr. Palmer, that's the music. We're going to go to a break. When we get back from the break, let's close out this conversation. And then since you're on the ground in Pineapple Land, I want to ask you a bit about the culture in that particular family island. And what do they think? If a liar is a thief and a thief is a murderer, where's the thin line between lawlessness and criminality?
Okay.
All right.
Back when you come back.
Yes, sir. You're on the clock with Aaron Green. We're going to a quick break. We'll be right back. So please stay tuned as we continue this conversation. Don't you really hear my mommy? Yeah. Use your discretion. Don't you look no reputations. The citizens complain over the radio.
Always on the go. Missed the show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Good morning. Welcome back to On the Clock with Erin Green. I got two questions on the table for the listening audience. Is lawlessness the same as criminality? And if a liar is a thief and a thief is a murderer, well, where is the thin line between lawlessness and criminality? Good morning, Mr. Palmer.
Yes, Erin. It's not an easy question. I mean, I see lawlessness as more of a general concept where there's a lack of adherence to established law. So that's like, you know, going through a red light, turning left on a red light, you know, not paying your property tax, you know, kind of general lack of adherence, right? Mm-hmm. Criminality is probably more something more intentional where you're going to go into somebody's place, rob them, or you're going to steal something. But they are kind of close, right? There's kind of a, like you say, a thin line between lawlessness and criminality. I mean, one thing I have to say, you know, the family eyes, and I lived in Eleuthera for a time, is that you do feel a lot safer. You know, you don't have that kind of, if it's law, you don't have that level of criminality, mm-hmm. you know, where people intentionally come and break into your house. I mean, I didn't have any locks on my doors when I lived here, and I never had an issue. I couldn't imagine doing that in Nassau. But in terms of, if you're looking at lawlessness, you know, what we had, you know, this year, in discussion the other day, we've already had three fatalities, traffic fatalities here on the island.
Three for 2024?
Just for 1 month, we had three people died. And so one of the reasons, you know, we're looking at, One Eleuthera Foundation is partnering with local groups and the police to do educational awareness on this. And one of the things they found is that a lot of people driving without driving license and without insurance. And that would probably classify more as lawlessness. So I'm sure there's lawlessness all over the Bahamas. But in terms of criminality, I would say, you know, you don't see it as much here on the Family Islands. It's much, much safer. So I don't know if that makes sense, but lawlessness does have an impact, right? When you're looking at, that's three families that have lost their people, and it's a super sad situation, particularly when you're in, you know, community where everyone knows each other, and so it has much more of an impact.
Absolutely, I think about I had an opportunity to speak with an officer in passing through the studio, and I just said to him, you know, I wonder if our focus in terms of eradicating or managing crime, our focus is askew. That while we're focused on the 10%, and that's a very rough estimate, the 10% of people that may be directly involved in criminal activity, right? That's what we're focused on. Would we be attaining better? Would we make more progress if we focus on the 60% of us that are lawless?
Well, right? You've heard of the broken window concept, right? This was a concept back in the 80s when, I mean, if you lived in New York, it was just crazy. I had a cousin who lived there at that time. And the theory was based on the idea that, you know, if there were visible signs of disorder and neglect and in a community, like a broken window or graffiti or things like that, they could contribute to an increase in crime and antisocial behavior. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a metaphor, but it probably also applies to, you know, letting things slide, you know, in terms of lawlessness. Because if you feel, I mean, well, I remember one thing they did in New York, they found that, you know, criminals were less likely to pay their subway fares, right? So yes. What they did is they just had the police waiting at the other end. And anyone who dodged subway, they found they generally had a criminal record of some sort. So there's definitely a link
right
between that. And so, you know, and out of that came the zero tolerance and various stuff. I know it's a little complex issue and I'm kind of, you know, talking about it in a very general term. But I think there's definitely a theory that says if you let those kind of, you know, just so simple things like going through a light, if you let, you know, you encourage people to do, you know, to push the envelope a little bit more and do other things.
Absolutely. Mr. Palmer, have you seen the headlines for today's papers?
I haven't, no. No, I haven't seen the paper yet.
All right. On the front of the Tribune this morning is a headline, "Don't give crooks contracts. Minnis says if he gave out names, he would fare for life." Mr. Nuri, you saw that headline this morning?
I did. I thought about Stew Fish, but I did see it.
I can't even afford Stew Fish. Some people have Stew Fish delivery.
Come to their house.
That's something. I'm just going to read quickly from this article, Mr. Palmer. Former Prime Minister Dr. Hubert Minnis urged his successor to commit not to give criminals government contracts, saying, "I cannot go into any more detail because my life would be in danger," close quote. Dr. Minnis's comment about what would endanger his life came after Prime Minister Philip Davis said such a commitment would only encourage criminal activity by taking financial means from people who would otherwise struggle to get employed. Mr. Davis recalled meeting inner-city residents who were on bail for several years. They said, "Brave, I had a construction job on PI." Someone whispered to the employer, "Do you know who that is waking for you? What happened? The fella next week or so, he ain't got the job no more." And this continued to happen. They are unemployable in the mainstream employment space. I'm going to stick a pin there.
So it's an interesting question because, you know, in many countries, England included, where I lived for a while, individuals with criminal records, they tend to face restrictions and limitations on their eligibility for, you know, said government contracts. But it kind of depends on their crimes, right? Say, for example, their crimes are related to dishonesty, fraud, corruption, that contract could compromise, you know, the integrity of the public procurement process, which we know quite a lot here, right? So if you have any of those things, you know, that they tend to look at that more seriously, because the way it's looked at, it's this balance, right? This mm-hmm. balance between, you know, we're very much Old Testament here, but it's a balance between rehabilitation and giving, you know, people second chances and the need to protect, you know, public resources, et cetera. So it's, you know, how do you get to that sweet spot? You know, if you say everyone can't do it, say you had some cannabis, you know, you have a criminal record because of cannabis, smoking cannabis, should that make you ineligible for a government contract? I would imagine not. But
no, especially when the government is actively and publicly engaging in discourse about potentially decriminalizing.
Right. And so, I mean, so there's minor crimes, right? If you're involved, you know, if you're involved in a fight with somebody, should that, you know, and yet you're a good contractor, should that stop you
prevent
from
getting you? Absolutely. Does One Eleuthera or any institution in or on Eleuthera operate a temporary work program or a work program for people marginalized from mainstream employment?
I'm not aware of any. Remember, it's a kind of a small community. I think we've got about 11, maybe 15,000 people here. So, yeah, but it's definitely, so I'm not sure, you know, what the level of, you know, how many criminals or you know, Lutherans we have that have come out of the criminal justice system. So I've got no data on that, but I'm not aware of anything.
Right. I mean, the conversation in itself is interesting. I'm not sure what ministers actually saying, if he's just grandstanding. But what we do know is that between Guardian Radio AM and On the Clock, like, we've addressed this. The appropriate approach is to create an independent, temporary work program.
Mm-hmm.
Independent of any political party or their power to disburse contracts, right? And that people who have been marginalized from employment because they're on bail, they may have been convicted, right? They're before the courts. That those people, if they have lost their employment, right, or cannot get employment, can come to this program and seek reasonable employment, if only for temporary periods. Like, you do a 3-month stint, and then you off for a month, 2 months to try and find work yourself. Now that you have some, you have a reference, and then you may, if you can't find work, you can come on for 2 to 3 months again. But no political party or no government should be disbursing contracts in this manner. So the question would never arise of whether a political party or a ministry or a campaign general is giving out jobs to people who are considered unsavory by some sectors of society.
Yeah, I thought it was more about the issuance of the actual contract itself. So for, you know, say maintenance of a government building, to the owner of that company having a criminal record. I read it more as that from the way you were describing it.
Absolutely.
So it's a slightly different conversation. I think, yeah, definitely, if you're looking at, you know, people coming out of prison, they have to be, you have to have some kind of rehabilitation, otherwise you're going to have high recidivism. You know, there's a lot of theory, I always bang on about theories of changes, right? The kind of actions and inputs that you take to reduce recidivism. And there are a lot of theories of changes out there that appear to work. And one of them is to do with that kind of transitioning inmates, you know, once they're released into work programs. And they're very successful ones. You know, I don't know if you've seen the ones with beekeeping, and various other initiatives. So there's lots of things we can look at, you know, and adapt to our local culture and environment.
All right. There's an interesting letter to the editor in the Tribune. It says, "Declare state of emergency, Mr. Davis." It starts, "Lawlessness continues to plague our nation. The year has just begun. The month of January is not finished, and we already at record-breaking numbers as it relates to murder. It is time the Prime Minister, under Article 29 of the Constitution, declares a state of emergency. We are in a serious crisis and losing the war on crime." To you, Mr. Palmer, and the wider audience, do you think that this is an accurate reading of our state of affairs? Do you think we've reached a point where the Prime Minister should declare a state of emergency?
Well, you know, there was another letter. I don't know if you read it. It was either, I think, earlier week, Ortland Bodie Jr., who writes some beautiful letters. And he was actually, his letter was the exact opposite of what this gentleman that you referred to just wrote.
Okay.
He actually said that pretty much all crimes were trending downwards, and that it was just specifically these, shall we say,
isolated
revenge over the hill types of crimes that had been increased, right? So, I would encourage people to read it, because it is it's well thought out and balanced, and actually brings a different perspective. Clearly, it is a difficult, you know, the situation is bad for sure, you know, and but he said it was, we shouldn't panic, because generally speaking, you know, the crime was actually trending downwards on other areas. And that a specific of crime that
deals. And so, you know, it's counterproductive, and the police have enough tactics in their armamentario to curtail and intelligence to do what they have to do to bypass a state of emergency. When I was in school in Jamaica, there was a state of emergency at one time, and where I was in Maypen, and I remembered we were going to the movies, and they said the tanks and the soldiers were coming through, and there's a state of emergency. So I have an idea what it is. And so I really have no idea what it is. They want it implemented. Maybe they could put themselves in a state of emergency and stay home. Now, having a family, as an elderly person, I think kind of different. Like, I was to the mall the other day, and so it was dark, but it was still early. Mm-hmm. So it was like 7, and I parked on the western side. And so as I moved to the car, well, obviously,